History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
Thank you. You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Kill. Find another black person, walk around, looking around, spotting another black person two blocks away.
Don't fuck with me!
Gravitate toward that person and find a reason to kill that person. We had an incident right here in Washington just a week or so ago where that old adage, that old, you might say, part of what you call black culture, what are you looking at me for? What are you looking at me for? I'll kill you, black person that looks just like me, because you looked at me. Now, white people look at you all day. White people look at you all day, or, you know, or they don't look at you because they don't even notice you because you're not that important. But here's some black person that you say, he's looking at me. What is he doing looking at me? And that's after going out of your way with a lot of us, let's tell the truth now, to get attention. Doing everything you can to get attention. And then when somebody gives you the attention, what are you looking at me for? You don't know me. And then bang, because that's what happened the other day. Bang, bang, bang. I'll kill you, person who looks like me. Why? Because you looked at me. That's why. I will kill you because you looked at me. Now, what is the look supposed to do? Well, you looked at me. Well, what is looking at you got to do with anything? Well, I don't know. I don't know why I do anything. I'm black. I ain't got no reason for what I do. I just do stuff. Just walk around on the street all day like a zombie, looking for something to do, and usually it's something that makes no sense at all. Now, that's not all black people by any means, particularly throughout the entire world. But in the Northwestern Hemisphere, that's a part of the culture that's been passed on. I heard stuff like that back in the early 1940s at least. And apparently, Marcus Garvey knew all about it back in the 1920s. This is 2016. We need to examine what we call black culture in fine detail and stop skirting around it and find out exactly what is the root cause of all of this. Of course, the root cause, in my opinion, is a system of white supremacy, which teaches black people that what you want to do in your life is find a reason to hurt yourself and other black people as much as you possibly can if you got color in your skin. That's the message that the white supremacists send to black people, particularly young black people, about their future. What you want to do with your life, since you don't have an idea of what to do anyway, I'll tell you, is find somebody that looks like you. Try to hurt them as much as you can, and in the process hurt yourself as much as you can, and just get the hell out of our way, because we're the only people that really count, the white people who believe in white supremacy.
Hotep, brothers and sisters, good afternoon and welcome to the Black Reality Think Tank. A people without the knowledge of their past history, origin, and culture is like a tree without roots. We welcome all of you here to the Black Reality Think Tank. We thank Professor Neely Fuller for that brief introduction. As you know, Professor Fuller was the mentor for one of our great ancestors, Dr. Francis Cress Wilson. And we thank him. He has a series of lectures that he does, and that was a clip from one of his lectures. We have a very excited program here this evening. We're here to talk about the black male narrative, and we have a wonderful guest who is going to come forward and share with us some of his thoughts. We are giving a tribute to the late, great John Singleton, who used his craft to try to speak on behalf of the black male. And so what we wanted to do is to take a look at that, see if he was successful, see what we can garner from that message and be able to use today for our young black males on the streets of America. So again, as always, we thank you so much, our listening audience, for participating and for listening and for coming on. We are here every Tuesday evening from 8 to 10 p.m. Every Tuesday evening from 8 to 10 p.m. And we look forward to more exciting programs in the upcoming weeks. Today was a very beautiful, sunshiny day here in Lithonia, Georgia. We broadcast from our studios here in Lithonia. Temperature was about 92 degrees, sunshiny, no sign of rain whatsoever. So it was one of those days that we all sometimes wait for, the good old sunshine, the good old summertime, and so it was here. So we are not going to prolong our activities here and our commentary. We want to get right into our discussion. But as always, of the Black Reality Think Tank, we always like to give an ancestral profile, praise our ancestors. We stand on the shoulders of greatness, and we always want to be able to say to our ancestors that we love you and appreciate you for what you have done for us and made it possible for us to be here. So we want to give tribute to one of our ancestors, and I thought I would use a filmmaker who was at the cutting edge of his work. We know him from a controversial way, but in reality, he was a freedom fighter. And I want to talk about him a little bit. His name was Spencer Williams. Spencer Williams. Brother Williams is widely known for his portrayal of the character Andy Brown in the controversial 1950s television comedy series Amos and Andy. His contribution to the world of film and television, however, far surpassed the limitations of the popular but widely criticized Amos and Andy sitcom. It was considered by many to be the modern version of blackface and Cooney, but Spencer Williams used it for another reason, and he fought very vehemently for liberation. Brother Williams was born on July the 14th, 1893, in Vidalia, Louisiana. Spencer Williams moved to New York City during his teens, and he studied comedy under vaudeville comedian Burt Williams. He attended the University of Minnesota, but interrupted his studies to serve several years in the United States Army during and after World War I. After being honorably discharged from the service in 1923, Spencer Williams returned to New York City and concentrated on a career in show business. He eventually landed a job with Christie Studios in Hollywood, where he co-wrote and appeared in Paramount Pictures' first all-black talking film called Melancholy Dame. Melancholy Dame. It was the first all-black talking film. So in 1928. He was subsequently retained as a consultant, a continuity writer, and a performer for the Christie Comedies, which was a comedy series that focused on black life in urban Alabama. By 1940, Spencer Williams wrote the script and portrayed a detective in the film Song of Engaji. Song of Engaji. It was a follow-up version of the King Kong clone Engaji. The following year, his own company, Amigo Films, produced The Blood of Jesus, a religious fantasy that concentrates on moral issues and religious themes. The Blood of Jesus is considered one of the most effective depictions of black church life in the South and was selected by the United States Congress for entry into the National Registry of Films in 1991. In addition to directing and writing, Spencer Williams appeared in nearly 20 films and composed music for most of them. In 1951, he was selected to appear as the lead character, Andy, on the Amos and Andy show, and also occasionally contributed to writing Amos and Andy's scripts. Although he is best remembered for his role as the slow-witted open, duped, and frequently unemployed Andy, Williams later protested the demeaning public image in which Hollywood subjected blacks to portray. He pressed for more serious depictions of blacks in motion pictures and attempted to rectify the stereotypical climate by making movies after the Amos and Andy series that were more in line with the American life. Spencer Williams died of kidney failure in his Los Angeles home on December 13, 1969. There have been many filmmakers. He worked very closely with people like Oscar Michaud, who also were writing and producing films to portray African Americans in a much more positive light. And so we wanted to do this just for the sake of our information. Let me give you a couple of other films that was done by Spencer Williams. He did one called Dirty Gertie from Harlem in 1946. He did another film called Go Down Death in 1944. He did one called Juke Joint, 1947. Did one called The Girl in Room 20, 1949. He did one called Making On in 1943. He did a cowboy, a western movie called Harlem Rides the Range in 1939. He did another one, western movie called Harlem on the Prairie, 1937. He did The Bronze Buckaroo with Herbert Jeffries playing the role in 1939. He did Beale Street Mama in 1946, and he did Brother Martin serving in the Army in 1942. A very dynamic filmmaker who was attempting to bring a more positive light in terms of African Americans. And so our tribute today was to Mr. Spencer Williams, because we're going to talk about Hollywood. We're going to talk about films in just a few minutes. We are dealing with our good brother, John Singleton, who recently passed at the age of 51, but by some considered to be a very brilliant and dynamic filmmaker. And so Hollywood has often played and depicted black life in ways that have had adverse effects sometimes. And so it's been our job to come forward and to make sure that a better perspective of African American life, you know, was presented. So that was a real big trip. And there are others. There were others other than Spencer Williams and Michelle during that time that were producing great films. Spike Lee, who we all know, very dynamic filmmaker, recently just won Academy Awards, did one called The Blood of Jesus. And he followed in that tradition of Spencer Williams as well. And those films are available for those, any of you who care to see them. And so our guest tonight, the dynamic brother, I've had a chance to meet him in the past. We had him on the show once before. Talking about, you know, his work and his art and his poetry. He's a brilliant young man, and I'm just so happy to have met his acquaintance and know him now. And so I kind of consider him my brother. He was my brother anyway. But I definitely consider him to be, you know, someone very close. And so we want to continue that tradition. Let me just tell you a little bit about our guest. His name is Marvin X. Brother Marvin X was born on May 29th, 1944. He is a poet, a playwright, and he is an essayist. His educational experience began at Merritt College, which is in Oakland, and San Francisco State University. Brother X is from Fowler, California. And he has taken the Muslim name Al-Muhajir. His work has been associated with the black arts, black aesthetics activity. He grew up in Fresno and Oakland in an activist household. He graduated from Thomas Alva Edison High School in Fresno in 1962. His parents published the black-owned paper of Fresno, California, called the Fresno Voice. So he comes from a newspaper publishing family. So you know he has some awareness that's extremely important. The 1947 paper advertised community events, local businesses, including their own real estate business, and focused on national and state events, including the promotion of anti-lynching laws, Jackie Robinson Day, New York Freedom Train being integrated, the mission work of the Catholic Church with Indians and Negroes, and the $350 million expansion of the PG&E in California. Marvin X has four living children and one son who preceded him in death. Because of Mr. Brother X's affiliation with the Black Panther activists of the day, Huey P. Newton and Bobby Seale and Eldridge Cleaver, and his work in black theater with Ed Bullins, Brother X is considered one of the major essayists and playwrights of the black aesthetics movement. He attended, as I said earlier, Merritt College, where he met Huey P. Newton and Bobby Seale, and he received his B.A. and M.A. in English from San Francisco State University. Brother Marvin has taught at San Francisco State University, Fresno State University, UC Berkeley, University of California, San Diego, Mills College, Merritt College, Laney College, the University of Nevada at Reno, and Reedley Community College. He has lectured at colleges and universities throughout this country, including the University of Arkansas, the University of Houston, both Morehouse and Spelman Colleges, the University of Virginia, Howard University, University of Pennsylvania, Temple University, Fresno City College, Medgar Evers College in Brooklyn, New York University, and the University of Massachusetts at Boston. Brother Marvin X attended Oakland City College, which I said earlier was Merritt College, where he was first introduced to black nationalism, and he became friends with future Black Panther founders Huey P. Newton and Bobby Seale. Bobby X earned a B.A. and an M.A. in English from San Francisco State University, and he emerged as an important voice, and let me underscore that, important voice in the black arts movement, better known sometimes as BAM, the artistic arm of the Black Power movement. This movement was embraced by such people as Ed Bullins, Amira Baraka, better known as Leroy Jones, and other powerful poets, the New Yorkers, and others who were performing during that time. The artistic arm of the Black Power movement was, as I said earlier, was a part of that, the whole idea. This was around the late 1960s. He wrote for many of the BAM key journals, which again is the Black Arts Movement, were publishing many key journals. He also co-founded with the great playwright Ed Bullins and others, two of BAM's premier West Coast headquarters and venues, Oakland's Black House and San Francisco Black Arts West Theater. In 1967, Brother Marvin X joined the Nation of Islam and became known as El Muhajir. In the 80s, he organized the Melvin Black Forum on Human Rights and the first annual All-Black Men's Conference. He also served as an aide to former Black Panther Eldridge Cleaver, and he created the short-lived Marvin X Center for the Study of World Religions. In 1999, he founded San Francisco's Recovery Theater. His production of One Day in the Life was the play he wrote about his drug addiction and recovery. It became the longest-running African-American drama in Northern California. In 2004, in celebration of Black History Month, he produced the San Francisco Tenderloin Book Fair, also known as the San Francisco Black Radical Book Fair, and the University of Poetry. He has taught Black studies, drama, creative writing, journalism, English, Arabic at a variety of California universities and colleges. And let me just say, he speaks fluent Arabic. One of the movers and shakers of the Black Arts Movement, Marvin X, has published 30 books, including essays, poems, plays, anthologies, and his autobiography called Something Proper. Notable books that he's written include Fly to Allah, Beyond Religion, Toward Spirituality, and How to Recover from the Addiction to White Supremacy. How to Recover from the Addiction to White Supremacy. Oh, that's got to be a deep one. In 2011, University of California, Berkeley, Bancroft Library acquired the Marvin X papers. He continues to work today as an activist. His awards include the Marvin X Day, which has been proclaimed by the city and the county of San Francisco, 2001. He is a life member of the California Scholarship Federation Honor Society. He is a member of the National Endowment for the Arts Writing Fellowship, which was bestowed upon him in 1972. In 1979, he was a part of the National Endowment for the Humanities Planning Grants. And so, ladies and gentlemen, it is just really an honor to have this brother with us. But not only has he accomplished and achieved so many of these goals, he's a humble brother, and he's willing to still work and do for our people. And we are just so pleased to have him here. So his words and wisdom for us today are going to be dynamic and powerful. So I want to start off by welcoming him to the Black Reality Think Tank again. And I also want to start off right away. And we played in our introduction a song called Follow Marcus Garvey. Follow Marcus Garvey. So let me ask someone who was a part of that early movement where a lot of that was promoted and pushed. Why do you think, Brother Marvin X, why do you think that we as African people did not follow Marcus Garvey? Why do you think we didn't do that?
Before I answer your question, Brother William, I don't know how I can follow that introduction you gave me.
Oh, it's worthy.
I don't know. Is that really me?
That's you. That's you, my brother. Yep.
But to answer your question, if time allows, I'd like to answer your question with a little brief essay from my latest book called Notes of Artistic Freedom Fighter Marvin X.
Okay.
Which is, if you know Paul Robeson, he defined himself as the artistic freedom fighter. So I'm standing on Paul Robeson's shoulders as well as Marcus Garvey. And I'll answer your question with what I wrote in my book about Marcus Garvey.
Okay. Great.
Pardon me?
I know I was saying beautiful. That's great.
Yes. So the title is, I Am Marcus Garvey.
Okay.
Are you ready?
I'm there. Yeah, I had a little interference. Someone came online. That's okay. I got you.
Okay. I am Marcus Garvey, Jamaica-born African man. The winds of Jamaica blew my soul, body, and spirit far and wide. I was a printer, then took off to see the world to unravel the riddles of the black man, African man, trapped deep down in the belly of the beast called colonialism. I traveled the Americas, Costa Rica, Panama, Honduras. I saw the suffering workers in these lands, studied their condition, and determined to free them. I went to England, where I met Deuce Muhammad Ali, the Pan-African who taught me one God, one aim, one destiny, Africa for the Africans, those at home and those abroad. I wrote in Ali's Oriental Times and Review. So did Booker T. Washington. I wanted to meet Booker T., so I went to the USA, but Booker T. died before I could meet him. I was heartbroken not to meet the man who rose up from slavery, who founded Tuskegee, who said, do for self, you can accomplish what you will. I wanted to know what happened to the black man's land. How did it become the pleasure of Europeans, the richest continent in the world? I wanted to make the black man independent, standing tall in his own land, not under the boot of Europeans. Africa for the Africans, those at home and those abroad. Where is our flag? In disgust at the white man's song, everybody got a flag except a cone. God bless me with the red, black, and green. Red for the blood of 100 million. Black for all African people. Green for our motherland. Fly the red, black, and green. Let the ancestors know you know them. Honor and respect them, the living and yet unborn. I am Marcus Garvey. Let our African legions march. Black nurses heal the wounds of our despair. Let the African poets sing songs of freedom. Let the colonialists dread the sound of our valiant voices singing in the winds of freedom, independence, and joy. I am Marcus Garvey. Let my newspaper, the Negro World, spread the truth of our blackness, African pride, and glory. We shall spread the words of freedom throughout the Pan-African world. Millions shall join the UNIA, United Negro Improvement Association. Millions in the USA, Caribbean, Europe, and the motherland. No matter those who oppose us, the winds of time shall oppose them in their wickedness, sycophants of colonialism. Yes, bootlickers who think they are smart, but only outsmart themselves. Their idea of freedom is yet slavery, for independence is the dream of every true man and woman. No man is free under the yoke of another, yet some intellectual black fools hate the idea of true freedom. They set traps for me at every turn, in league with the FBI and other agencies around the world. The devil sent Negroes to sabotage my ships, the Black Star Line. Black spies infiltrated our UNIA. The FBI began with their spies in my midst, along with the jealous, envious Negroes who hated blackness. We call them black men with white hearts. Somebody said these Negroes are white men dipped in chocolate. In Spanish, we call them coffee con leche. I am Marcus Garvey. What was the Harlem Renaissance without me? I published all the poets in my newspaper. It was the spirit of blackness that made the Renaissance possible, not white patronage that made us exotic birds of paradise. I am Marcus Garvey. With the help of sellout Negroes, call them niggas, the USA falsely charged me with mail fraud and jailed me, then deported me. I passed away in London, never visiting Africa. Yet today, the red, black, and green is the universal African flag of liberation. Long live black nationalism. Long live the red, black, and green. One God, one aim, one destiny. Africa for the African, those at home, and those abroad. Up you mighty race, you can accomplish what you will. Look for me in the whirlwind. Look for me in the storms, hurricanes, tsunamis, earthquakes in diverse places. Look for me in the eyes of our children who carry the torch of freedom in the marrow of their bones.
Ooh, boy, Lord have mercy.
Thank you. Thank you, Marcus Garvey.
Oh, Brother Marvin, Brother Marvin. Man, what a way to open up this program. Oh, my goodness. Oh, that's so powerful.
Yeah.
Oh, that is so powerful. I appreciate that. That is just, that embraces the whole concept of what we're trying to do here.
Yes, sir.
So thank you so much. Thank you so much. I was online about 3 weeks ago, maybe a month, and I was recuperating from my surgery. And I was just, you know, just kind of reading through a lot of stuff and just being quiet. And I ran across an article that you had written where you were sort of critiquing and reviewing the films of John Singleton. You were giving tribute to the brother there. And these were some, man, I read that piece and I kind of felt the same way that I feel about this piece that you just read now. And I sent that out to everybody. I sent it to all of my little network systems. And I hope some read it, some didn't. And I said, I got to have him on, and let's talk about that, because this is something that we wanted to do now. Because actually, I had not seen, even during the times that he was still with us, and the films were coming out, I had not seen a real major critique of those movies. And those are some powerful pieces to me. And my favorite of the male films, which was, you know, Boys in the Hood, Baby Boy. Baby Boy was one of my favorites because he opened up with Frances Cress Welsley and some of her stuff. And that's why I started off with Neely Fuller today. Brother Fuller has been addressing some of those things. So to start off our program today, because we are addressing the black male narrative, what is it that the black male is saying? That's what we are asking when we say the black male narrative. What is it that we understand about the black male that we need to know as parents, community leaders, activists? What is it that these young brothers are saying? And I think John Singleton attempted to try to portray some of that. And so we want to talk about it. So why don't we start off, you know, for those who have not read your critique, with you reading the critique. And
absolutely.
Then from there, we'll launch into our discussion. How about that?
Great.
Okay.
So in honor of ancestor John Singleton, I wrote this review several years ago, and I'll read it to you, and then we can continue our discussion.
Okay.
From Boys in the Hood to Baby Boy is not much progress. Or is it a necessary return to the scene of a crime for a closer look at the evidence, to figure out a motive, to clarify certain thoughts on a problem that has proven a conundrum? Certainly, the situation of the black man in America is such a problem. How did he get here? Why? And how will he get where he wants and should be? The movie opens with some definitions of boy, crib, mama. And I was waiting to hear man defined, as in the man, as in white man, as opposed to black man. I've been told John lacks political consciousness. So perhaps this is why he didn't go into the man, but stayed with baby boy, an easier task, yet difficult enough to confound the greatest minds in the world. Du Bois, Garvey, Elijah, Malcolm, Fanon, Hare. These are a few of the men who've tried to decipher the innards of the black man's soul, heart, and mind. So we must give John credit for stepping into high cotton, for attempting to answer a most profound question. How do we get the black boy to manhood? Especially when many fathers have long gone, and society deals with the question as a criminal matter. Especially when the Oedipus drama between boy and mama reaches the climax or gets out of control. On one level, the answer to all this is very simple. Manhood training is a prescription John's movie tries to fill, initiating the boys into manhood. Since the Black Man's Conference in Oakland, 1980, many organizations have come on the scene to offer manhood rights for black boys. From coast to coast, there are age grade ceremonies and rites of passage. But most of these programs are relegated to bourgeois youth. The ghetto boys must fend for themselves. At least John had enough sense to transcend gang socialization and affiliation as a solution, because it is mostly a case of the blind leading the blind. The sole elder, our manhood facilitator, is the mother's boyfriend, an ex-convict trying to do the right thing after a 10-year journey upriver. in spite of his serious limitations, including the neglect of his own children, he initiates Jody into manhood. The boyfriend is the only adult male we see, although we hear previous abusers of Jody's mother and of his father, we learn very little, mainly that he is long gone. The typical situation in the hood where the black man is a premium and often a rarity in the family or anywhere else. After all, the black man is busy escaping from the ever-encroaching white man and his variety of viruses from jail, prison, alcohol, drugs, homosexuality, infidelity, insanity, hostility, etc. We see the mother's boyfriend is a killer, and he comes close to taking Jody out in a fit of rage that might be excusable as a manhood training exercise. He had to show Jody who's the man, or at least the elder or the authority figure. A similar procedure practiced by the police when they stop ghetto youth for the slightest matter. They terrorize them, punch them, hit them, choke them, often before asking for ID. In the end, Jody is dancing to the boyfriend's music, literally and spiritually, suggesting his maturity. But John takes us into the surreal for this to happen. We see Jody shot multiple times, but in the Christian tradition, surfacing from the deep structure of the movie, Jody is crucified, resurrected, and completes his journey into manhood. He ascends. He leaves his mama's nest and goes off to create his own with his ever-insecure baby mama. In spite of their immaturity, the couple reveal deep love and affection, which is usually the case with the woman. But we never doubt that Jody loves his baby mama, number one. I really appreciated John's ear for our language. It was precise and true to people in the hood. It was poetry to my ears, a vindication of the freedom of speech the Black Arts Movement presented and the rappers extended. Now, Peanuts, baby mama number two, is lost in the shuffle, which is another problem that John Singleton was obviously incapable of dealing with, as are most Christian and most Muslims, the problem of the other woman. So Peanuts is like Hajar and her daughter like Ishmael, abandoned and sent into the desert to be forgotten. At some point in our existence, we must deal with the multiple families we have created. If polygamy is not the answer, then what is? It was obvious Jody was not mature enough to handle one woman, let alone two or more. And he really didn't try. But clearly the women in the hood wanted him to be their baby daddy too. I really appreciated John's ear for our language. It was precise and true to people in the hood. And it was raw but natural. Thank God the culture police didn't censor him, because they have no originality or creativity, only moral hypocrisy. Let the people speak their language. Let their voice be heard. Freedom of expression is a political act protected by the Constitution, or it was before 9/11. I enjoyed the love scenes. They, too, were natural and not the usual fake-looking arrangements. And the mama's boyfriend, butt-naked in the kitchen cooking breakfast, was a monster. The motif of the mother in the garden worked for me, except some close-ups of the vegetables might have made them not look so phony. The mother in the garden and in the house was central to what baby boy was all about, getting the bird out of the nest, out of the garden, out of the house, so mama can have a life and the boy can become a man. Without daddy, There's only so much mama can do. And the boy warriors are so rebellious, an early exit is necessary. They cannot linger pretending to protect mom. As mom said, whatever happens in love is going to happen. Don't get me wrong, Jody had a right to be concerned about his mother's safety, since she had a history of hooking up with violent males. But after OJ, the violent male is a top priority of the criminal justice system. Often the children become obsessive in their concern for mama, as if they can pick and choose who mama sleeps with. The mother was forceful in demanding a life of her own. She was busy kicking birds out of her nest, or out of the crib, as we say. For a moment, I saw sparks of Death of a Salesman when Jody decided to do for self and began selling women's clothing. This was revolutionary. Maybe John does have some consciousness. Jody had enough sense not to sell dope and not to work for the white man. And he was quite a salesman. John could have told us why Jody chose to sell women's clothing, aside from the fact that women have money on a constant basis. They can always get money, I've heard. But selling to men is a problem because of player-hating, jealous, envious brothers, something the movie could have discussed at this point, because this has great relevance for the state of mind, growth, and maturity of the black man. Why is it so difficult to sell something to another black man? When I was a dope fiend, I made it a practice to never buy dope from a black man. My choice was the women dope dealers who gave up love, as we say. Why can't a black man give another black man love and justice? This has everything to do with manhood training, and John failed to pick up the ball here. I know brothers who sell women's clothing for all the above reasons. But finally, the movie was too long. There came a point when we knew nothing else could happen except the moment of truth, as they say, when the bullfighter kills the bull. And we wanted to see the blood and get it over with. The brother coming home from prison and returning to his ex-girl's house was a prescription for homicide in the hood. With so many young men caught up into the criminal justice system, this is an important issue that should have been dealt with as such. But it was done in a middle life fashion, not exploring the sensibilities of the brother coming home, to no woman, to no family. It could have been treated on a deeper level without getting the script off focus. Snoop Dogg did a great job with the limited script. With respect to the woman, it has to do with control, power, and ownership, as if the woman is chattel, personal property. This must be a subject in the curriculum of manhood training. That's her pussy, Mr. Black Man. If you can control your dick and protect your dick, you will be doing wonders for yourself and the entire community. The dialogue over pussy and dick was boring, probably because I've heard it throughout my relationship with women, and I refuse to go there at this point in my life. I don't want to discuss what I do with my dick or what you do with your pussy. Whatever we do together is our business, and what I do without you is mine, and what you do without me is yours. I have transcended flesh. Too many of my friends have made their transition behind flesh. I don't plan to go out that way. It is said half the brothers in prison are there behind trying to impress a woman or behind a woman that they have convinced themselves they were in love with, when in most cases the brother didn't love himself because he had no knowledge of self, and most especially no knowledge of his woman. John Singleton accepted a great challenge when he wrote, directed, and produced Baby Boy. But one thing a young man lacks is wisdom, for it only comes with age or in deep consultation with the elders. If he had shown the young brothers meeting with the elders, the movie would have taken us as a community to a new level of consciousness. One day such a meeting will take place and be the subject of movies, because it will usher in the reconciliation and stabilization of our community. We shall go nowhere as long as our young boys must fend for themselves, reinvent the wheel of fortune. The challenge is not on the young, but on the elder black men who must step to the front of the line. Time out for marching and talking. Marcus Garvey told us the world is moving against all unorganized people. Black men, get organized.
Brother Marvin.
Yes, sir.
Guess what?
Yes, sir.
You preaching today, my brother. I know you got your robo. I know you got your robo today. Man,
I'm like the woman's man in Baby Boy. I'm butt naked in the kitchen.
That's exactly right. You are butt naked in the kitchen. Cooking. That's what you doing. That's all right. That's all right. I just want to say to our listening audience, you're listening to the Black Reality Think Tank. Our guest tonight is Brother Marvin X, who is laying down the Holy Ghost, the African Holy Ghost. Tonight we talk about black males and giving tribute to our dear beloved brother who transitioned to the ancestor world, Brother John Singleton, and his work and his vision that he's done. We are discussing that. This is a call-in format. You can call us and give us your questions or comments. Our number is area code 215-490-9832. I repeat, area code 215-490-9832. You can call us at any time, and we will acknowledge you, and you can either ask a question, make a comment. This is powerful. I mean, this is you know, you talk about you know, a lot of times in the old black church, you know, they have what they call spring revival.
Yes.
We got revival tonight. This is straight up revival. So and I really just appreciate brother that. So let me start off. You know what? I can use this as a way to combinate the two things that I wanted to talk to you about today when you came on the show. You are also the chancellor of a university called the Academy of the Corner, Academy of DA Corner, and it's located.
Well, let me correct you.
Okay, good. Please go right
ahead. As far as that term university, Dr. Nathan Hare, my esteemed elder and associate, he told me, Marvin, don't use that word university, because ain't no university had no time for us.
Okay.
You know, he was kicked out of Howard and San Francisco State, and
yep.
I was only briefly allowed to teach everywhere you mentioned earlier.
Right. Yep. That's right. So how
the Academy of the Corner is my classroom on the street, and as far as I'm concerned, this was the true mission of the student revolt, especially that we had at San Francisco State, which is, we're at the 50th anniversary this year for the fight for the establishment of black studies and ethnic studies. But the mission, primary mission of the students, and I was one of the founders of the Black Student Union, previously known as the Negro Student Association at San Francisco State. So our mission was to take knowledge to the community.
All right.
Not necessary to get tenured Negroes jobs for life.
All right.
But to take the knowledge to the community. So this is what I'm doing with Academy of the Corner.
All right, and you know, that's so interesting, because that's one of the things that we have been promoting here on the Black Reality Think Tank. We talk about what we call, we call it Saturday schools, but we only use that as expression in terms of meaning the weekend for the community to hold schools. And so you are actually going on the corner of 14th and Broadway in Oakland, California, right?
It's not only 14th and Broadway. I also have a class on Lakeshore Avenue, which is a few blocks from downtown, but it's a whole different neighborhood. And then I also have a class at the Berkeley Flea Market in Berkeley,
okay,
which is another crossroads for black culture in the Bay Area.
Okay. Okay, so now tell me how you do it. You put up a table, I assume. Explain the process of setting up that corner to have
tables. Well, let me try to cut to the chase.
Okay, good.
Now, allegedly, I'm selling books.
Gotcha.
Mostly my books, Dr. Hare's books, and other conscious books. But if you know the condition of our people, when you set up, and when you are, basically, you are sitting duck, basically.
Right.
And people come by, our people, and not only our people, white people, everybody. But people come by, and they're in various states of mind. Mentally, some are mild, moderate, and severe.
Right.
And so they have a lot of trauma, they have unresolved grief, and they want to talk to somebody. Who wants to listen to our problems? Ain't nobody got time for our problems. We got our own problems. So who wants to listen to a Negro's problems? Marvin X.
Right.
Because
right.
I like to listen to people because it gives me something to write about. But seriously, the people come in various states of grief and suffering. For example, you may have heard of Oscar Grant, who was killed by the police out here. You may have heard of other brothers and sisters who've been killed by the police or other cases of homicide. But you must know, you need to know, there are many, many cases that people, families have suffered the loss of a loved one. And there is no news report. There's not even a police investigation. There's no rally. There's nothing. So these families are suffering, and the family members, they come by. That's who comes by 14th and Broadway. So they want to talk to me. And sometimes they get up in my face, literally eyeball to eyeball, because they want to make sure I'm paying attention to them.
Okay.
They look at me straight in my eyes, and they want me to listen to them, just listen to them. And so I've had all kind of situations that have happened. I just want to mention one. One day a young black man came by, and he wanted a book. He probably said he didn't have any money. A lot of people don't have money. And usually I give them a book. And sometimes I have angels that come and sit with me, and they listen to who comes there and what they're saying. And if they hear the people say they ain't got no money, they'll pay for the book immediately.
Probably.
But this day, this young man came by, looked at the books, and I gave him a book. He walked a few feet, and then he stopped, and he turned around and broke down in tears. I said, "Brother, what's the problem?" He said, "Man, ain't nobody ever gave me nothing in my life." Right. You didn't hear me.
Right.
You didn't hear me.
Yes, I did.
So then another time, I had one book, I think it was called I Wish I Could Tell You the Truth. So I had gotten a good deal on this book from the printer, so I had ample copies. So God told me to go down to 14th and Broadway and give the book away, give it out. So I did that. And, you know, I didn't hear nothing, no response for a few weeks. Matter of fact, I wasn't even on 14th of Broadway. I had set up on Lakeshore. And two young men came by. They walked by. And then they turned around and walked back to me and said, Marvin X. I said, yeah. They said, we just want to shake your hand. I said, what's up? They said, we was on the bus. And we found half of your book, that book, Wish I Could Tell You the Truth, and it changed our lives.
Wow.
It changed our lives. So, you know, if you can save one person, you're doing great, right?
right, exactly.
So
okay, so I get a good picture of what you're doing. I get a good picture of that.
You say what?
I say I'm getting a very good picture of the yes. Of the academy and what you're doing.
Well, let me continue. So,
okay.
A few weeks ago, I was at the Berkeley flea market. It's not like it used to be. You know, it used to be a booming crossroads of black culture in the Bay Area. But with gentrification, many of the blacks have been forced to leave Berkeley as well as other towns in the Bay Area, including Oakland and San Francisco.
Okay.
They simply can't afford to live here any longer. So the flea market has gone down, and as a matter of fact, a few weeks ago it had closed down because they couldn't pay the expenses. But anyway, the flea market opened back again, and this particular weekend I was supposed to go to the Bay Area Book Fair in Berkeley, downtown Berkeley. I had arranged to go, and I was going to set up with the National Writers Union booth, which I'm connected with the National Writers Union. But in between time, Facebook had kicked Mr. Farrakhan off Facebook. So I was very upset with white people. And so I decided, God told me, well, go to the flea market and be with your own people, because the Berkeley Book Fair is mostly white people. So I went to the flea market, even though it was, as I said, it's not like it used to be. Many stalls were empty, vendor stalls were empty, but I went there anyway because it was beyond money. As a matter of fact, as I told you a moment ago, I had been on Lakeshore earlier in the week, and my angel had come by, and she sat there, and every person that came to my table and said they didn't have money, she reached in her, you know, where women reach.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
and paid for their books. So I had been blessed that week, so I wasn't tripping about money. I didn't want to be around these white people. So anyway, I set up, and here again, it wasn't about books. It was about people coming to me one after another, sharing their grief and trauma, talking about family illnesses and mental illnesses and homeless compounded with their illnesses in with family members. And this went on the whole day, one after another. So I've told friends about this, and they say they're going to get me a white doctor's coat.
Yeah.
And
listen,
you
have
your, you know,
and you have your preacher robe hanging up over there behind you.
So this is Academy of the Corner, brother. Not only that, as a function, but the Academy has also been a manhood training center.
All right.
Because the brothers come, and I have several chairs. Some people have donated chairs, so I have them in my SUV or whatever it is. And so the brothers come and congregate, and I let them sit, you know, behind the table. and we have conversation, and they're from different backgrounds, religious, political. Some are Muslim, some are Sunni Muslim, some are Nation of Islam, some are Rasta, some are 5%er. So I tell them, I have one rule. No killing.
All right. That's good. Yeah. Yes.
No killing. Because, you know, these conversations get very heated.
Oh, they do. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. They do.
Yeah. So we get along. We get along just fine. You know, the brothers are able to talk. And the sisters are welcome. They join in. They come in. You know, we don't cut them off. They got something to say. They just want to be heard and not be drowned out.
Right.
But the sisters come also.
Powerful.
So.
All right. Well, yeah. Okay. Let me ask you, getting back to the critique of your brother Singleton, how would you use, for instance, Baby Boy as a curriculum if you had an opportunity to have, say, several young men in an audience that you are, you know, are talking to you? What would you hone in on specifically in order to sort of instruct them and to sort of grasp their attention to what's being said here? What would you use?
Well, as a matter of fact, William, the other night I was talking with a lady, a single mother, who's raised her son. She put him through college. The father died, so I guess she got insurance money to, so she could send him to college and everything.
Okay.
And he graduated from college, but he's still at her house. And he say he ain't leaving.
Okay.
So I sent her the review of my review of Baby Boy. So she could see, because that's a prescription.
Yeah.
He gives you a prescription of what mothers have to do. You got to get these birds out the nest.
Yeah.
And sometimes they don't want to leave. And even, I think you know now, with this economic situation and students, many children are coming back home. And I heard one say the other day, she's coming home and ain't nothing mama can do about it.
Yeah, okay.
So it's that type of situation. But again, basically, that movie is a prescription. So for what the man must do, what the youth must do, because it ain't just boys, it's some women that's out of control too. And they're physically abusing the mother, physically, emotionally, and verbally.
Yes, they are.
You know, John didn't, he didn't go into that too much in the movie, I don't think. It wasn't too much physical abuse or verbal abuse or even emotional abuse. The boy just had to be pushed out. And he was all in his mama's business.
Right, he sure was.
You might call that emotional abuse.
Right.
But anyway, so it's a prescription. It's a learning tool, a teaching tool that we can use, because sometimes we don't see what we're doing unless you show a look at the mirror, as Michael Jackson said. Look at the man in the mirror.
Right.
Look at yourself. And maybe you can understand.
Right.
So that's how I would use it. It's a teaching tool.
Okay, exactly.
Yeah.
Because one of the things that's very clear, he uses a lot of symbolism, and he's, like I said, he's borrowed from, you know, Francis Crest Wilson stuff, you know, particularly the language, crib, you know. Things like that, other usage of the words, that saying that they're still in that infantile state.
Yes.
So let me ask you this. Where does that come from? What has caused that among our young brothers? Why do they refer to. Even, you know, even the word MF has some very strong symbolic connotations to it.
Yeah.
And I've read some stuff on what some of that means, you know, because a lot of times in the slave system, we had to watch the slave masters rape our mothers.
And ourselves.
That's right. And that's right. Exactly.
And ourselves. Exactly. And our children.
That's right. That's exactly right. So, in a bigger, where does that come from?
Well, you know, I put this up under a category I call the psycholinguistic crisis. And which means that we have a, what will they say in linguistics? A basic vocabulary.
Right.
Basic vocabulary, what, bitch, hoe, motherfucker, all that.
Right.
That's how we address each other. You can say that's a product of oppression. We've internalized the oppressor's language. Now, sometimes we flip it. All these negative words become how we express love. You my nigga, nigga.
Right, exactly.
You know I love you, bitch.
Yep, that's exactly right. We do that. We do that. We definitely do that.
Motherfucker, you know I love you, motherfucker.
Yeah.
Yep. On and on and on. So we can redefine these terms. But sometimes they become, you know, like people get on me about using the N-word.
Right.
But when I grew up in West Oakland, in the Harlem of the West, nigga wasn't no bad word. The bad word was black.
Yeah.
If you
that.
Call somebody black, you might have a fight.
That's right.
And one of my partners, a yellow nigga, he told me the other day, he said, man, we was talking about this, and he said, man, you know, I'm a yellow nigga, man, you know, and you know, I couldn't call no nigga black because they really whooped my ass.
Right, right.
Yeah. So, language is fluid and dynamic, and words change with time, and it's a matter of do people want to adjust? Do we want to? Now, what did Cornel West say about the NAACP having a funeral to bury the N-word?
Yeah.
Dr. West said, how's the NAACP going to have a funeral to bury the N-word and they still acting like niggas?
I like it. That's right. That's right.
Yeah. Some, hey, man, I've been in situations where a man was talking about my language, use of motherfucker, and he was a child abuser.
Whoa.
So what's worse, saying it or doing it?
That's right. That's exactly
saying
right.
Saying it or doing it.
That's exactly right.
What's really profane and obscene? Saying it or doing it?
Right.
You know, so I say we're in a crisis.
Yeah, we are.
We're in a psycholinguistic crisis, and it's part of, you mentioned my book, How to Recover from White Supremacy. So part of the recovery process, you know, will obviously be to get an understanding of the psycholinguistics of our addiction to white supremacy.
Yeah, that's a big
And then in the process of recovery, maybe we want to come up with a new language.
Yeah, that's really true.
Yeah, as far as I'm concerned, we can leave the whole English language is vile and obscene and profane to me. It's called a bastard language. It is a bastard language.
Yeah, it is.
So how you going to try to nitpick and cherry pick this word and that word and don't say this and don't say that and don't say this and why you say that? Come on, man. Give me a break.
Right.
I mean, as a writer, I got to use all words in context. And if you read my 30 books, I say more than bitch, hoe, and motherfucker and nigger.
Right. Okay. Well, listen, we've got some listeners on that I'm sure want to say something. I'm gonna take a real quick station break, and then we're gonna come back, and I want to open up the lines and let the
okay.
And our listeners.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
History, a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
My brothers and sisters, we have a dynamic discussion tonight here with Brother Marvin X. We have a call-in format. If you have some questions or want to make a comment, you can do so by calling area code 215-490-9832. And I repeat, area code 215-490-9832. And Brother Marvin would be perched to answer any question that you may have. A dynamic guest, Brother Marvin X, and we are discussing the John Singleton movies. This is a sort of a little tribute to John Singleton and his work and his vision on trying to quote the black male narrative. And we are looking at that now, and we truly have an expert with a long experience of doing that in his work and his vision. So let's go to our lines, and as we always, we have our wonderful callers. I got my dear and beloved brother here from Philadelphia, Brother Timothy. How you doing tonight, Brother Timothy?
Hey, you know what, brother? You connected me with Brother Marvin X again, and we got to pick it back up where we first left off. The interesting thing about this, Brother X, Marvin, and also Dr. Rogers, is that my other half cousin was here. She came Thursday from San Leandro.
No, she didn't.
Yes, she did. Listen to me. This is coincidental. And we were just talking about the Bay Area, and my queen just took her back to the airport to go home. And we were just talking about, because she wants to move from San Leandro to a place called Rio in California. Is it a place called Rio in California?
Called what?
A place called Rio, California.
I don't know. Rio. R-I-O?
I don't know how she spelled it, but she says she's moving out of San Leandro because it's pricing her out of this world. She was just talking about that.
Yes. But, well, black people are in migration out of the Bay Area.
Yes.
They're moving all down into the Central Valley towns and like Stockton and Sacramento and Fresno, Modesto.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes,
but they're on the move. They're being forced out of here. And, you know, this is happening nationwide.
Yes,
nationwide. And the point is, it's not even white supremacy.
Right.
It's globalism.
Yes,
these investors who are buying all this property, they're not white. They're Arab. They're Chinese. They're Russian. They're African.
Right.
They're Mexican.
Yes, they are. Yes, they are. But let me tell you something, Brother Marvin X. I'm going to tell you this, Brother Marvin X. I'm going to say this to you, that when you start talking, the first thing that came to my mind is I can't help from putting you and Amiri Baraka together. I swear to God. Listen to me. He would use the N word. He was the only one that I could use the N word you wanted to hear come out of his mouth. He had a way.
Well, we were only friends for 47 years.
Let me tell you something. He had a way of using that word, and he would tell you that the oppressor could be black and white. He said, sometimes color don't make a brother. And he would tell you that black skin, white mask. And you
that was his combat. That was the way he would use his sword to tell you about the traitor. But let me first tell you this. Listen to this, right? You know, I'm a graduate of Lincoln University, and I'm always in and out of all that Gil Scott Heron does. And in his book, Pieces of a Man, he talks about how he's influenced by Mary.
Yes.
He's influenced by The Last Poet.
Yes.
And he said Muhammad Ali came on that campus because he came on 67, 68, and he was there for a certain amount of length of time.
Yes.
And he said that what lured him to there was a person that Mary Baraka talked about all the time in front of my face was Langston Hughes.
Yeah.
And if you look at Gil Scott Heron,
yeah.
And you listen to Gil Scott Heron.
Yeah.
And I never met him, and you know where we came from.
Yeah.
You would have to say that he was influenced by all them people, but he was first a poet.
Yeah.
Then he was a writer, a composer, and a musician. It was his poetry that you, the way you speak, and Amiri spoke. You know. And, you know, Muhammad Ali, there's a film out on Muhammad Ali right now called What's My Name?
Yes.
Yeah. Right? You talked about Paul Robeson saying that he was artistically an actor, revolutionary. Well, Ali and himself, with his mouth and his art, was a poet. He was a poet.
Very good poet. Great poet.
Great. I don't think people realize how much poetry that he...
They haven't heard some of his poetry.
Man, let me tell you something. They could see the boxes behind off. That was one thing. But his poetry and his ministry and his poetry, and we all come from that we're woven from that clock, that cloth.
Let me go back to what you said about Muhammad Ali and What's My Name.
Right.
See, I've been commissioned to write a play on the 400th anniversary since 1619.
Right.
And so I got to put this together. And so I'm writing in my head, and I've written some of it out. But one thing I'm sure I'm going to utilize is this question. What's my name?
Right.
And my question that I want to deal with, and I've written poetry about this, but I'm going to go further in the play. How do we get Toby back to Kunta Kinte?
All right.
What is it going to take? Now, wait a minute. Now, we know how Kunta Kinte got to Toby with a black bullwhip.
Right.
With a black bullwhip.
Right.
So I'm saying, are we going to have to use reverse psychology or reverse physicality?
Right.
And whoop Toby back to Kunta.
Right.
In the same way Muhammad Ali had to make that Negro call his name.
Right.
Are we going to make Toby, have to make Toby call out, I'm Kunta, I'm Kunta, I'm Kunta.
That's right.
Right.
That's right.
Now, I'm going to say this, Brother Marvin X, I'm going to say this, that from 1915 to 1919, Paul Robeson went to Rutgers. You know that. Undergrad. Played football.
Yes.
And in 1919, he coached Lincoln's football team that year.
Yes.
Can you imagine that?
I didn't know that.
Magnificent scholar and athlete. And then he matriculated from 1919 to 1923 to the University of Columbia as an attorney and became a magnificent actor. So on that campus of Lincoln University, I say to myself, I could do so many books on Kakuma, Nnamdi Azikiwe, Langston Hughes, Roscoe Lee Brown. I could just go on and on. Thurgood Marshall. I could go on and on. Tristan Fleetwood, who who fought in the Civil War and who fought in the Civil War and graduated from Fink University in 1860 and fought in the Civil War. Paul Robeson's father escaped from North Carolina.
Yes.
Went to Lincoln University, got his degree in 1866.
Wow.
And met his mother, Lisa Marie Bastille, and married her, and his aunt Gertrude. So I said to myself, that you just bring this all out of me, man, but I'm saying now we're talking about film, and we got to talk about Robeson. You can't, but you also got to look at, you got to put Spike Lee in there and Singleton. They're treasures. I mean, he's a treasure. Should we look at Spike now? How are we going to look at Spike 50 and 60 and 100 years from now is another. But we're looking at Spike now. See, they waiting now to make things on Ali. And his wife is doing a good thing by never letting his name go. But we should study Muhammad Ali, the messenger, Marcus Garvey, Duke Boyce, Booker T. Washington, every day, man.
That's
we need him every day now. We need him more every day than we ever did.
That's right.
You're right.
That's right, brother. That's right.
Now, I'm going to tell you, when it comes to film, I mean, if we go all the way back to what they did in the 20s, what Spike did with the Miyu Sen, the use of the jacks, the use of the montage, and all that artwork that he did, he's not the guy who does the other stuff. What's the guy's name who does Madea? He ain't no real filmmaker like Spike.
That's a total difference.
Yeah, it's different.
Yes.
But he does his thing for his genre. That's his thing. We do our thing. But But the other thing I want to say to you, other calls to call and pick up, is that guess what I saw last week and I thought about you. I want you to get the book, Elaine Brown, A Touch of Power, A Taste of Power. And she talks about the rift that Huey P. Newton had against the Nation. And the next time we talk, we got to talk about that, brother, because the way that Huey came up with Louis Farrakhan and his soldiers, a man-to-man confrontation that they settled. That's another issue there in California.
Well, let me say this. Hey, let me say this, brother. You know, I knew Huey very, very well, and he said I was his teacher. I said he was my teacher, so I guess we taught each other. But I know one time he said, see, Brother William.
Yes.
Only a few select people call me Jackman.
I know. Okay. I know. Yeah.
They got to be killers to call me Jackman.
I got that. I got that when you told me today.
I won't say. I didn't say that, but Huey Newton called me Jackman.
Yeah.
But anyway, Huey said, he said, Jackman, we a party. But a party can be part of a nation. He was talking about the Nation of Islam. Because we were trying to connect him with the officials in Chicago. I was at Huey's penthouse when he was right up above the lake here, Lake Merritt on Lakeshore, in this penthouse. So we called Chicago and tried to connect Huey, come and see the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. And, of course, he was ready, but the officials, and, you know, we don't have to go into they, you know, they blocked it.
Okay.
But as I told Bobby Seale, I say, you were influenced by the Nation. I said, look at your program on your paper. Look at your 10 points. All you did was paraphrase Elijah Muhammad, what the Muslim wants, what the Muslim needs. Oh, Bobby said, oh, no, Jackman, we came up with this ourselves. I said, so you wasn't influenced by the Nation, huh? No, Jack. I said, did Malcolm X influence you? Did Malcolm X influence you? Well, okay, Jackman, okay then.
I hear you. That's right. Brother Timothy, I'm going to come back to you in a minute, Brother Timothy. Let me go over here and see Brother Marcus. Brother Marcus, how you doing this afternoon?
Yes, Dr. Rogers, good evening, and good evening to your guest, Dr. Marvin X.
Yes, sir.
You're spitting fire this evening, brothers. Fire coming out of your mouth.
Yeah, brother. Yes, sir. Yeah, he lit it up.
Yes. You know, the first MF, you know, was keen, because if you read that story, he was sexing his mother. If you read that story in Genesis, he also, he's the first MF. But
yeah,
I tell you.
Yeah, Oedipus, yeah.
I tell you, Garvey, when you mention Marcus Garvey, to me,
yeah,
his name is more revered in my book than Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
That man,
yeah,
was a powerful man.
Yes.
Because,
yes, yeah,
Indonesia's Independence Day is Marcus Garvey's birthday.
Yeah.
Mao Zedong and Chiang Kai-shek came to Harlem, listened to Garvey, and said, you know what, Asia for the Asiatics. That sounds sensible. They,
yeah,
took the key and went to freedom. You,
yeah,
know, everybody followed Garvey's plan and went to freedom, except,
right,
you know who.
Yeah.
We're trying to divert from that. That is the solution, because if other races took it and went to freedom, then why the hell we can't embrace it? We want,
yeah,
to deviate. We want to twist and turn, you know. But look, there is no solution for us here in this country. We're actually in prison. We are actually prisoners in this country.
Right.
Because
we're in the big yard.
We're in the big yard. The food we eat, we don't produce that food. So the,
yeah,
cracker could poison us. Okay?
That's right. Why
poison
should
your
he?
Water.
He's the devil. Exactly. What you think the devil's supposed to give you? Organic?
Exactly. Exactly.
That's right. That's
the
right.
Clothes we wear, we don't manufacture them clothes. And he has known to give people clothes lately with smallpox.
That's
right.
Right? That's
okay.
Right.
The educational system, it,
yeah,
miseducates us, turns us against,
yeah,
ourselves. You go to the doctor said, you know what? You have insurance. Oh, you know, you need this or you need that. You know, they make money, they benefit, and obviously we have no protection because,
right,
we can't say, the police, he's the warden. The police,
yeah,
is the warden in the big house. So the only solution is to either get out of the big house or,
yeah,
try to tear down the big house. You,
yeah,
know what I'm saying? It ain't no other solution, because this system is designed to drive our people crazy. And as you said,
oh, you're right about
street.
That.
Well, I think they've achieved their objective.
Exactly. They have driven us crazy. And,
yeah,
just being in the same environment with him, the same local,
so,
is a detriment to our.
But it's,
know,
like,
so,
it's like Elijah said, he had to use tricknology. So I say we got to trick the trick out of the tricks.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, we've been
like
tricked. So now we got to trick the trick out of the tricks.
And I like that last statement you made when you talk about Kunta. It took,
yeah,
pain,
yeah,
and violence.
Good.
We
got to
get him
point.
Back. We got
to
get Toby out of here and bring Kunta back.
Got to. But we need to be in our own environment. This environment is a hostile environment.
That's true.
I don't think
that's
we
true.
Can fix ourselves here. 400 years,
well,
is long,
well,
enough to
then,
know.
You know, you're right about that. There's a whole thing about, it's called neuroplasticity.
Mm-hmm.
Which means if you change your environment, your brain cells will follow. Your brain cells will change.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
See, I lived in solitude in the mountains north of Oakland,
mm-hmm,
up there where that fire was in paradise.
Mm-hmm.
I lived there for 5 years. In the mountains, in solitude. And,
yep,
when I would be in Oakland and I would go back up there to write, after about 2 weeks, I was in a different state of mind.
Yep, yep.
I didn't want no alcohol. I didn't need no alcohol, no weed, no kind of drugs. I didn't even need soda and juice. The water was sweeter than juice.
Yep, he was away from the madness, away from the confusion.
Yeah.
So this society is a nut.
So
anyway,
I know I'm not the same person.
Yes.
And people could tell. When I come back down to Oakland after about 2 weeks, they say, okay, Marvin, I think it's time for you to go home. Because I was starting stressing.
Yes. Well, I appreciate this program, and I appreciate you good brothers.
Thank you so much, Brother Marcus. Thank you.
Keep on keeping on. Thank you.
Okay.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Brother Marvin, let me ask you, since we've been kind of dealing with filmmakers and looking at some of the messages that they portray in terms of black folk, what are you familiar with the brother? His name is Antoine Fuqua.
I believe so. What does he do?
He's the one that I think he also produced What's My Name, directed that. He also did The Equalizer with Denzel Washington, both 1 and 2. That he's doing some of those kind of tough movies like that, in that way. He did Brooklyn's Finest. I think he did that. Yeah. He did Olympus Has Fallen. Which all have some very deep messages in it. I want to ask you, what do you think about that image that he has been portraying, like for instance of Denzel?
I'm not really familiar with it.
Okay, because he has Denzel as a very strong. He's a former CIA undercover government op who has retired. That's out killing up a whole bunch of white folks. I mean, he's killing them up left and right.
Maybe I did see it.
And I'm just wondering what since you're critiquing the movies, what is it that you
But that isn't that kind of similar to the spook who sat by the door?
Yep. Same thing.
Yeah.
I just wanted to ask you what role do you think that has to play in the black male narrative? Because, historically, obviously, if you talk about killing white people.
I'll say this. Everybody has a role.
Okay.
There's something for everybody to do.
Okay.
And I'm proud of that billionaire that just paid for those brothers' student loans at Morehouse.
Uh-huh.
And he should be a model for all these well-heeled Negroes of what they need to do. Because you can't take that money with you.
Right.
You can't take it with you. So do something with it.
Right.
And I'm blessed to have had a patron who enabled me to get my 30 books out. Ain't no white man did it.
Right.
They ain't touched my books. And half these Negroes, they're not going to publish my books or help me get them published.
Right.
But there's a role for everybody. There's a, like one of my friends said, there's a progressive black bourgeoisie.
Yes, it is. No doubt about it.
You know, and sometimes people are doing a lot of things you don't even know about. Because they don't want it to be known. But they're helping. So there's something for everybody to do to push us forward instead of backwards.
Right. I don't know if I don't know if you've seen this, but the white press is attacking the brother who made that donation to Morehouse. There's an op-ed piece today in the New York Times where he's saying that ain't gonna do no good. I don't know whether that's going to help anything. He's just really just so negative about it. And the key point is that he's missing the whole point of why he even did that. Only another.
I don't know if the last time I was on your show, did I read you my dear white folks letter?
No, you didn't.
Let me see if I can find it.
Get it.
It's
and
not
why
that
you
long.
And why you While you're looking for it, I got a sister that's on the line. I wanna bring her
on. Bring her on.
Okay, because I know she's got always had some profound things to say. All right. Sister Benicia, how you doing?
Greetings, Dr. Rogers. How are you?
I'm wonderful. How you doing? Thank you so much for calling me.
Greetings.
Hey, listen, thank you for telling me about this because this has been excellent.
Thank you.
Just excellent. I want to give my greetings to Brother Marvin X, is it?
Yes.
Brother, greetings. I want to thank you, Asante, for the presentation that you've been doing, what you've been sharing. It's just been very powerful, and a couple of callers. So I just want to share something related to what was said earlier. I have an organization in the South here, and we are developing community along the lines of the Nguzu Saba, the Kawaida, and the African principles of building community. And so I was telling the young people, about the seven principles and the Black nationals and whatnot, and how Africans operate, because I was sharing that, we're operating with Black people with European mindsets.
Right.
And I said the way you do things is to have the elders pass down to you what we've learned, and we can pick it apart and look at where we made mistakes and correct those and move forward and do, add whatever works and use whatever has worked in the past. And the young people kept saying, well, we got to figure out how to do so-and-so. We got to figure out how to do this, in terms of moving forward in the struggle.
They want to reinvent the wheel.
Right. I said, reinvent the wheel. Yeah, exactly. I said about five or six times, no, this is how we do it. The elders have done everything that you're sitting here saying, that you've been saying for the online and everything. We've done this. Just redo it. And what didn't work, don't use it. What works, use it. They literally could not grasp listening to the elders. And that blew my mind. It went over their heads. I was watching their eyes glaze up. and I hear so many young people.
Well, it's a lot of static in their heads.
Yeah, but I hear a lot of young people.
It might be a little radiation, too.
A lot of radiation. But I hear a lot of young people say, nobody never taught me anything.
That's right.
And they have parents, and they have a little bit of community, but they say, nobody ever taught me anything. So, Brother Marvin X, when you said that the elders' job is to not be marching and all that nonsense, but get back to teaching the young people, that was, so critical, because I'm seeing impact of that not happening.
When I used to go to one barbershop with young barbers in there, and the young people would come in, the young brothers, and I couldn't just go in there and get a haircut. They say, OG, teach us something. Tell us something, OG. They say when you was coming up, OG, if you caught something, all you got was a drip. They say, if we get something, we die.
Wow.
We die. So it's a different time. So they made me teach. I had to get paid for my haircut, teach, and give them a tip.
Wow.
The young intellectuals now, they can't hear from the elders. They're actually verbally abusing the elders. Y'all didn't do nothing. Y'all integrated. They are waking up to the fact that integration was a bad idea. And they're angry about that because I work with a lot of young people.
Yeah.
And so, that piece of passing it on to our youth is so critical because they are distancing themselves from the elders. And once you have a Black community divided on that level, we got real serious trouble.
Well, we just have to do what we supposed to do. And as a matter of fact, I addressed some young people a few weeks ago at a club here in Oakland. And I had a conversation with them on stage, and the brother that was interviewing me was 21, I think, 21. So he said, Marvin X, you 75. Tell us something. What can you tell us? So I proceeded to
talk like I've been talking for the last hour or so. You know, raw.
Right. Right.
You know, because they want to know and they don't know. I mean, you can mention, we know all these books about Garvey and Booker T and Deuce Muhammad Ali, but you don't understand, these kids, they heard none of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
We assume that they know what we know, but they don't. I don't care if they've gone to black studies, because a lot of these black studies is just watered down, middle light shit.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I know, because I've been in black studies, helped start it off. So I know what I'm talking about.
I know that, too.
They give you a Miller Lite, and I ask people come up to my stand all the time, students. They never heard of Dr. Nathan Hare. Well, how could you have gone to San Francisco State University and studied black studies, and you ain't heard of the founder and the first chairman of black studies? How's that possible?
There you go.
Some don't connect. But let me say this. As I said earlier, this is the 50th anniversary of this strike at San Francisco State for Black Studies, the longest strike in American academic history, and probably the most violent, although nobody died like Kent State and what was that, Orangeburg and other places.
Right.
But on the 50th anniversary of the strike, the California Historical Society, the Ethnic Studies Department, and the administration of San Francisco State, they put on a celebration and initially didn't even have a black person on the panels.
Oh, man.
You can't even believe that. But wait a minute. So what I'm saying is, one reason the kids don't know is because they don't tell them.
That's
those
right.
Who know don't say. Who should say? They say nothing.
Exactly.
Wait a minute. I was at my hometown. Aside from Oakland, I grew up in Fresno. Plus, I taught at Fresno State in '69. So this is the 50th anniversary of my teaching at Fresno State, which I was removed on orders of Governor Ronald Reagan, who was the governor at the time. I was in Fresno, and one of my cousins is married to a professor, retired, who was there in 1969. And I mentioned to him, I said, you know, man, don't you think we need to do some type of acknowledgement of what happened in 1969? Oh, he said, oh, Marvin, man, no, man, we done went past that, you know, and everybody, we want to forget about all that, man. We ain't nobody trying to have that, all that. You want to come here and cause trouble, man. We ain't nobody got time for that.
That sounds familiar.
So why do you think the kids don't know what they're supposed to know?
And wait a minute.
This is also the 50th anniversary of the strike at Columbia University in New York. And there was an article in the New York Times saying the same thing that I just said about the black students who kicked off that strike at Columbia University. The narrative has been revised so that SDS put it on and other white students put it on. The blacks didn't do nothing.
Hmm.
Same thing they did at San Francisco State. So when you say the kids don't know, there's a reason. You know, for example, I spoke in a class at San Francisco State a few weeks after after that celebration, and I asked the students in the class, did any of you go to the celebration of the 50th anniversary of the strike at San Francisco State? Nobody raised their hand. Class full of people. And so I said, well, you didn't go because people didn't want you to go. Because if this ethnic studies had wanted you to go and the school had wanted you to go, you'd have been there. Wait a minute. One more thing. I just gave a reading. They had a reading at the San Francisco Main Library a few weeks ago on the 50th anniversary of the strike, a poetry reading. So all the San Francisco Bay Area poets came, mostly white, and Asian. A couple of us was black. And the audience was mostly white at the main library. So as we're reading poetry, they're showing a video of the strike. Who's in the strike? Black people. Who's in the video? Black people.
Yep.
So it's like a propaganda. We're in a propaganda war. Donald Trump, bless his heart, fake news.
Yep.
Fake news. So our kids don't know because they've been listening to fake news.
And Malcolm said you've been bamboozled.
Bamboozled,
yes, yes. I just wanted to say one thing. I know, I know that we know that all of this is strategic. You know, I've just become made very, very much aware that the next strategy in dividing African people is dividing the youth from the elders. And I'm just asking everybody to pay attention to that and to do everything we can to snatch our young people back. Just like you were saying, brother, take Toby back to Kunta Kinte. Because what I see is very concerning, and they don't. Our young people oftentimes they don't feel loved, and so let's pay more attention to them. And I'm just saying that to general, you know.
I'm saying this. I'll say this: we have a, as they say, a daunting task, because you can't go around kids anymore and talk with them when they're on their cell phone.
Oh, yeah.
When you're on the computer playing games, playing how to kill, how to kill, you can't have a conversation with them. In some cases, even with my grandkids, I just stop. I don't even try anymore.
I make mine put it down. Make my nieces and nephews put it down.
Then you got a big argument. Hey, you got a big argument, and then they say, Grandpa, you use the F word.
That's right. Ooh, you curse. Yep.
Dr. Rogers, I'm getting off so somebody else can call, but thank you all again.
Well, listen, thank you so much, Sister. Brother Marvin, I just wanted to say real quickly, Sister Ayan, Bernice with us on, went to the school in New York, you know, the East, which I'm sure you're familiar with.
The sister just got off?
Yeah, the one that's on now. She went to the East.
No, you weren't. You weren't part of the East.
I was a part of the East with Big Black, G2AOC.
No, that was my buddy.
Really?
Yeah, of course. I was back there when he was in the hospital. In his last days, I talked to him.
I moved south, so it's been years. But I went to the school, got my education into Black nationalism, and, you know, that shaped and molded who I am. And I've been an activist for many years, bringing our people back to those principles. So that's what I mentioned earlier, the Nguzu Saba.
I heard you.
We built.
She's very good at it. She's very good at it. I wish we had more time to talk about her project.
Bring me down your way sometime.
I was going to ask you if you come and do speaking engagements.
I do them all over the country. But I have to tell you, a few years ago, I was in South Carolina on a speaking tour. But when I got to South Carolina, they say, we not doing nothing for you. We ain't going to give you no book party. We ain't doing nothing. We just want you to go jump in the ocean and have some fun, or go out to the African village. You know the African village down there.
Yeah.
But
no, we ain't like that. We're about black empowerment and building. We're about building.
They said, you Cali Negroes come down here and mess with this white man, and then he retaliates on us when you leave. Because he know what family you stayed with. And they're going to retaliate.
Ooh, that's deep.
Wait a minute. I went to Staples because I did some writing down there, and I went to Staples to get the manuscript copied. And the young sister said, where are you from? I said, I'm from here. She said, no, you ain't. You ain't from here. I said, why you say that? See, the book, the manuscript was How to Recover from White Supremacy.
Okay.
I finished it down there in Beaufort County, Gullaland.
Mm.
But anyway, when she saw the title, she said, "You ain't from here because we don't say that down here."
Well, this is North Carolina. A lot of us are from New York and D.C. and California and Jersey, and we're bringing that that courage down here because, you know, Southerners are full of a lot of fear. So we're bringing that courage and helping
to
pull them up to the fold.
Good way to
put it. So, well, yeah, brother, I'd like to get you down here.
Well, I'm ready to come anytime, you know, depending on my schedule. We can work it out. I'm on my way. As I said, I got to do a production in Austin, Texas, in a few weeks.
Mm-hmm. All right. So, Doc, can you give us
I'll share the number with you. Yeah, I will.
I don't know if you're comfortable giving anything out on phone, but
You can get my number from Doc.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I will.
All right.
Make sure. Okay.
All right. Well, everybody. This has been beautiful.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay.
Black love.
Yes. Black love.
Take care. All right, brother Timothy. You got 1 minute to say anything you want to say.
The one in D.C.
Brother Timothy.
Hold on. I'm sorry. Sorry, Dr. Rogers.
Yeah, I said you got about 1 minute.
1 minute. Well, listen. I've been all ears, and I'm happy everybody expressing what they have in their mind. My thing is, I want to say, you got to bring Marvin X back.
He's coming back. He's coming back.
For themselves.
Okay.
We got to let everybody have him one at a time.
Okay, gotcha. Okay, Brother Marvin, and close it out, tell us a few things that you got coming up. I know you're getting ready to try to republish some of your stuff, and you have a fundraiser that you're doing. Anything you want to say about that?
Well, yes, I could use any donations. People want to contribute. There's some type of fund on Facebook. If you're on Facebook, you can go there, or you can just call me. If you want to donate. I have a square. I can take credit cards. Call me at 510-575-7148. 510-575-7148. If you'd like to make a donation, my next book is really, I know I can say the title. I can say everything else tonight, right?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
The title is The Mythology of Pussy and Dick.
Okay.
In a poetic notes on the human condition in the Me Too era.
Okay.
Now, the majority of the material in this book I wrote 10 years ago, but nobody wasn't ready. So now it's the Me Too.
Okay.
So this whole idea and situation of sex and sexual abuse and emotional abuse, verbal abuse, is worldwide. So I'm bringing out my collection of materials that I've written over the last 50 years on that subject. The Mythology of Pussy and Dick. You can look it up.
Okay.
And, you know, I did a whole tour on this subject in 2009.
Wow.
I went to Grambling, Louisiana. I went to Jackson State. I went to Howard University. I spent a whole week at Howard University lecturing on the Mythology of Pussy and Dick.
Okay.
Imagine that at Howard University is 14 women for every man. Yeah. So what do you think them girls are in class texting about?
Yep.
I was in one class, and the girl said, "I thought I was cute, but when I got to Howard, it's 13 more cute girls."
Right, that's true. And it usually is like that. It usually is that way.
So we got a problem. Part of it's the patriarchal mythology of white supremacy and even African supremacy.
Right.
For example, I just was talking to a brother from Ethiopia who had visited Ethiopia. And he said, "Marvin, you know, the Ethiopian women are the most beautiful women in the world. But most of them have been subjected to female mutilation. And they have no feeling when making sex."
Wow.
This is what he told me. He said there was one area or women from one area, one tribe or whatever, where they did not practice female circumcision, and these were the girls that were favored in the sex trade.
Well,
so this problem is worldwide, so I'm trying to throw everything I've learned in my 75 years about the subject.
Great.
And maybe
great.
It'll help somebody. And as a matter of fact, I started off with an 18-page pamphlet, and I'll go back to what I was telling you some of the young people say. And one young brother, he read the pamphlet, and he came back. He said, Marvin, after reading your pamphlet, now I can go live my life.
All right, all right.
He said, because I thought I owned something that I don't own.
I got you. Well, listen, Brother Marvin.
Wait a minute. One more thing, brother. Okay. And then some other young brothers gave out the pamphlet. One brother gave out the pamphlet to his partners, his friends, and he came back and reported to me. And he said, Marvin, two of the young brothers read your pamphlet, and they went to court and got custody of their children.
Oh, I love it. Okay.
So well, that's listen, the work I'm working on right now as we speak.
Okay, we're in overtime, so. I really appreciate you. You know I do. Every time I ask you to come on, you never hesitate. So I'm going to be calling you back. You know that. Maybe we're...
Anytime, Brother William. I'm here. What else? Hey, what else do I have to do?
Beautiful. Thanks a lot. We thank our listening audience for being with us this evening. We hope that you have definitely been empowered by the words of my great brother, Brother Marvin X. Have a wonderful week,
thank you.
And we'll see you.
And they can Google. You can Google me. My main blog is Blackbird Press News. You got to say news. Blackbird Press News. Okay. Thank you, Brother William.
Thank you. Take care now.
Black is you. Black is me.
Peace
black
out.
Is us. Black is free.
Send me the link.
Black is me. Black is us. Black is free. Black is us. Black is me. Black is us. Black is free. Black is free. Black is me. Black is us. Black is free. Black is you. Black is me. Black is us. Black is free. Black is me.